Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, good evening and welcome to San Clemente Punk, proudly part of the Fight Words Radio Network here on blogtalkradio.com. This is San Clemente Punk for St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 2014. Sorry we're late, guys. We've had a lot of problems with the board, which followed, you know, last week I had my computer crash on me. But I'm really excited about, in about a half hour, we will have the show that I've been looking forward to the most for a very long time, and we're finally able to meet up and get these guys on air. We'll be interviewing Stan Mueller, who is part of the Punk Chronicles. He has written and is in the process of finishing up the movie, which is a documentary about Ill Repute, Clean Cut American Kids, the story of Ill Repute. We'll also have Jeff Fourier-Hocken, and I'm sure I destroyed his name, from Firehawk Entertainment. We'll talk to Jeff Hershey, who is the promoter of Nardcore, which is a fest that's all about Nardcore and the Nardcore sound and Nardcore movement and all that. Not really movement. It was a group of musicians that really destroyed the misconceptions of how punk music was supposed to be played out in that part of the country. And we will also be joined by Carlos Valdez, who was one of the original members of Ill Repute. So that'll be in the second hour, and I'm really excited to see that or to talk with those guys. Because of the computer crash, I lost most of my music, but I have, I still have music on here on Blog Talk, but all my new stuff is gone, which really sucks. This, though, is Crawl Unit, which is the band that kind of arose out of the ashes of Shit and, Purdy Spit's still around, The Uncivil out of San Clemente, California. Purdy Spit is out of Tacoma, Washington, and they're starting to play again. But this, though, is Crawl Unit with I'm Not a Member.
Don't remember. Colors, and they always say the
Okay, that was Crawl Unit, band out of San Clemente area, Orange County, California, that Troy Uncivil is now a member of. We're going to move on to Jawbreaker. This is Jawbreaker with Equalized off of their demo tape that I happened to pick up at Burt's Records and Tapes down in Delaware a long, long time ago. This is out of print and very, very difficult to get. This is Jawbreaker with Equalized. Jawbreaker with Equalized. Sorry, guys, I'm having a hell of a time with the board, but I think it's figured out now. We're going to move on to, this happens to be one of my favorite songs by Jello Biafra. When he went off on his own with DOA, he did Last Scream of the Missing Neighbors. It was 1989. It was a collaboration between Jello Biafra and DOA, DOA, of course, being out of British, Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada, they got together and they did the, it's about about 25, 30 minute, it's about 45 minute, album, but, it was notable for. It was like a 14-minute Full Metal Jack-Off is just a rant on the the whole Contra, Iran-Contra affair with Ollie North, crack, all kinds of stuff. You know, they touch on everything. Joe Biafra did the vocals, and DOA backed him up basically on the sound. But this is Joe Biafra and DOA from Let Us Scream of the Missing Neighbors with Attack of the Peacekeepers. DOA with Attack of Peacekeepers. Stiff Little Fingers took their name from a Vibrator song of the same name. When Jake Burns, Henry Clerny, Gordon Blair, and Brian Falloon got together, they were originally called Highway Star. They're at a Belfast, Northern Ireland. Once Gordon Blair left, Allie McMorty took over, and they became Stiff Little Fingers. This is my favorite song by these guys. I know a lot of people think it's Alternative Ulcer, but it's actually Suspect Device. This is Stiff Little Fingers with Suspect Device.
Don't believe that.
Okay, guys, that was Stiff Little Fingers with Suspect Device. We're about 7 minutes away from being joined by Stan Mueller, who is the mind behind the new movie about ill repute. Anyway, we're going to jump in here with the global threat. Here we are. Was a global threat with Here We Are. We'll be joined shortly by Stan Mueller, who is the man behind the new movie about ill repute, which, you know, I'll let him get into it. But I'm really excited to get Stan on here and talk to him about the Clean-Cut American Kids, the story of ill repute, which is going to be both a book and a documentary about the Nardcore band. We're going to move on now, though. We got a couple more songs we can play. We're going to move on real quick. But this is... I'll play that. Yeah, why not? Iggy and the Stooges, Search and Destroy.
With a hat full of napalm, I'm a runaway son of a nuclear age bomb.
The interview with Ill Repute. We're gonna play this Poison Idea with Nothing Is Final. To be pigeonholed into any kind of expectations of what a punk band should be. Formed in 1981 at the Port Hume Naval Base, the band Ill Repute were the most unlikely group of kids to destroy the conception of what was acceptable to be a punk rock musician. Fronted by John Phaneuf, the band consisted also of Tony Cortez on guitar, Jimmy Callahan on bass, and will be joined later by Carl Valdez, who was on drums. Ill Repute was part of the wave of angry, charged, and honest punk rock called Nardcore, taking its name from the Oxnard, California scene that spawned it. Fast forward to 2013, and Stan Mueller decided to take on the monumental task of documenting the band, as its heart and soul is still very much alive and is still destroying the misconception that punk rock was about uniformity, but actually more about individuality. I am very, very pleased to welcome on San Clemente Punk, Stan Mueller. Stan, thanks so much for joining us tonight. How are you?
Good. How you doing?
Great, great. Stan, I got to tell you, when I was approached by you to do this, I mean, I damn near jumped out of my skin. Ill Repute has been a long-time favorite of mine, and thank you so much for making this happen.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it, helping us get the word out, and I feel the same way. You know, Ill Repute was always, you know, one of my favorite bands growing up as a kid, and to be able to find the right team to put this project together, you know, it's been a blast from day one since this project started about a year ago. So, yeah, we appreciate the time you've given us to talk and share this project with everybody.
Not a problem. Not a problem. Now, Stan, how did you first become involved in punk rock music as a whole?
Well, for me in general, it was more something that I got into as a youth. You know, I remember my brother taking me to shows, you know, when I was in eighth grade, ninth grade, and just falling in love with it, just the rawness of, you know, just being a kid and other kids expressing themselves the same way. And just I was drawn to the music. And, you know, for some people, the music was, I guess, you know, in a sense, ugly and distorted. But for me, man, it was beautiful. So I don't know, maybe something, you know, twisted in my mind. But for me, it was just gravitating to a scene that it was put on as, you know, it's always do-it-yourself, you know, kids putting on their own shows. And I was just drawn to that. And so just going to shows as a young kid. And I remember, you know, just buying albums, you know, going to the local record shop and buying albums and picking up, you know, Mystic Records and not knowing who any of these bands were and, you know, going home, putting them on and just being, like, blown away and just hearing Ill Repute back then, you know, picking up their 7-inches, hearing them on different compilations. I was just the band I was always into.
Right. Now, your brother kind of segued you into it. How did your family feel about that, about you guys, you know, being into punk rock?
Yeah, you know, back then, you know, it's you know, there's always a little trouble going on, you know, as youth. But we're actually essentially pretty good kids. I mean, we would get into trouble, mischief and stuff like that, and, you know, sneak out, go to shows, and they parents don't know half of what we were doing. But, you know, for the most part, we were getting things done. You know, we were still in school, getting, you know, passing somehow, and you know, we a lot of the, you know, just personal choices that we made that, you know, didn't take us down the wrong path, because, you know, there's obviously a lot of turmoil that could be involved in a scene like that. But, you know, my parents were cool. They, you know, very supportive. Yeah, we didn't have any problems.
Okay. Now, how did you become involved in documentary film work?
Well, you know, documentary film work it's really just, for me, it was teaming up with the right person, right people. You know, what we do is we write books. My wife and I, we have a business. We're ghostwriters, so we actually write books for people. We started a business about 7 years ago called Universal Writer. And, you know, and it's really cool. It's really cool to learn about other people's lives and helping them formulate their books. You know, we've worked with all sorts of people from, you know, professionals, from therapists to, you know, athletes, you know, charities, whatever. You know, we've worked with it all. But I've always, you know, I've had my passion for the punk rock music, you know, and I just wanted to formulate something. So essentially what we wanted to do was a book, but then I wanted to take it to the next level. I'm thinking, you know, a book's cool, but, you know, it'd be cool to package it with a documentary. And that's when, you know, I was researching and I got a referral. And that's how I hooked up with Jeff Feuerhaken, who's actually the documentarian. He's the one that filmed it. We collaborated together on it. And then another gentleman by the name of Matt Switzer helped us film it as well. And just teaming up with the right people that to get it done was really the biggest part. You know, once, you know, I got the referral, I called them up, and we were, you know, they happened to live about 5 miles from me. So I drove over to their house that night and explained my idea, you know, how I envisioned this project to go, and they were on board. And literally 3 weeks later, you know, I remember just driving home, calling Tony Cortez that night, saying, hey, I want to not only do a book, I want to do a documentary. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. And we started making phone calls, started emailing, and 3 weeks later we're in Ventura filming it. I mean, it was that quick, you know. And then as we're filming it, you know, we were approached by Jeff Hershey, who's going to be joining us later, and he's like, hey, you know, if you guys could complete this thing in time, why don't you premiere it at our first NARD Fest, which is a huge Nardcore music festival. And we said, yeah, let's do it. And, you know, we pushed through it, a lot of hard work. I mean, you know, we all have full-time jobs, and this is, you know, a passion project, you know, and we were able to get this thing going, I mean, down to the wire, but we were able to premiere it. And I think it was like 5-6 months after we started filming, we were on, you know, at this festival for showing it to people, you know, the first version of the first cut of the documentary. And there was a lot of hype behind it. We were stoked. A lot of people came in early to that show to actually see it. So we got a lot of good feedback from people.
Did this ever feel like either the book or the movie? Did it ever feel like work? I mean, was this just something that you loved that much that it never really felt like that?
Yeah, it never feels like work. You know, it's like I tell my wife every day, I'm like, I wish we could do this full time. You know, just pick bands that I love growing up with and turn, you know, projects into them like this, with, you know, and it's just great to hang out, you know, and go to shows, and it's just, you know, being able to just be involved in something and learning about a music scene that, you know, for me, I wasn't from the Oxnard Ventura area. You know, we're further south, and a lot of the bands that, you know, I really was into, you know, I was a little younger, so I didn't get to see Ill Repute back in 83 or 82, or, you know, I didn't get to see a lot of these bands in their heyday. I didn't start going to shows until the late 80s. And by then, a lot of the bands already stopped playing. You know what I mean? They weren't playing the old stuff anymore. They were doing that crossover to metal. And so, but I still had the passion for the old stuff. So now you got these bands back together, and they're playing all the old stuff. And just being able to talk to them and hang out with them and learn their stories and understand where they came from. I never knew where Ill Repute came from. Man. You know, I just looked at pictures, and you read some interviews here and there, but you didn't know how rad they were and where they came from, and being able to actually learn their story and the way this project is formulated. I mean, we take it back from day one where these guys were born, and you know, these guys were, you know, parents that were in the military, so these guys are bouncing around the country, you know, and it's just interesting where how they all bounced around but ended up in the same spot, and you know, how they just grew up in Southern California in this community, and, you know, really resided and still reside there. And so the fan, if you're a fan of Ill Repute, you're going to learn things about this band that, you know, you never even thought of, and just where they came from and their history. And it's really cool. It's really cool to show that to people.
Now, when you started this whole process, you know, you kind of touched on who you involved. Was there any other bands that you had thought about before Ill Repute, or was it always Ill Repute?
Yeah, you know, there is a at first, I initially wanted to do just one big book about the whole Nardcore scene. It was going to be all the bands, and I actually even went out there a couple of years ago and interviewed a bunch of people, like from Aggression and Stalag 13 and Dr. No and all those bands, and I rented out this cheesy hotel, and they all just came, you know, I just scheduled it, and all these guys would just come throughout the day, and I was interviewing them, and it was really cool. But I was thinking, man, it's kind of it just wasn't the right process. It wasn't, you know, I was thinking, man, these guys deserve their own product, their own thing. So,
right.
And I always kept in touch with Tony the most, you know, and Carl. And when I met them, you know, back on that first time around when I went out there, it was, you know, those guys were always just so open to this, you know, and always so willing to help coordinate. And that's half the battle, man. There's a lot of cool bands out there
right. That
would be cool to document, but it's like, are they available? Are they even going to give you the time of day, you know? And these guys were on board, man. They really made this possible for us to do this. They helped schedule. They gave me a list of people. Reach out to these people, you know, and set this up and really pointed me in the right direction and supported us, you know, in this whole endeavor. I mean, you know, Carl Valdez led us, and we crashed on this floor for 3 nights, you know, filming this thing. And you know, just they opened the doors to us, and they knew we didn't have any money, you know, and they said, hey, come stay with us, you know, and let's do this. And it was such a cool experience. And and Jeff, when he called in a little bit, you know, filming this with us, you know, filming this movie, it was just really cool that people just started coming out to woodwork, and you know, it was, you know, I could tell in some situations these people haven't even talked to each other in a while, and it was cool to get them together. It was like a little get together, you know what I mean, a reunion of sorts. So it was fun.
Now, I want to play Fill It Up by Ill Repute, and we actually have on the other line, we have from Firehook Entertainment, Jeff. So let me play this song, and then I'll come back, and we'll both be live.
Rad.
Okay. This is Fill It Up by Ill Repute. BlogTalkRadio.com. Tonight we're talking with Stan Mueller, who wrote Clean Cut American Kids, the story of Ill Repute. And we're joined now by Jeff, who assisted him on the film. Jeff, I slaughtered your name earlier. Could you please tell us how we pronounce it?
Oh, hey, it's Feuerhaken. And I do believe that you're not the first person to ever slaughter my name. I think it might have been done once or twice before.
But, Jeff, how were you involved with Firehook and everything in making of the movie?
Oh, well, Firehook is my production company, and we basically got hired through Stan. Well, we met and had a little chat about putting this Punk Rock Chronicles thing together. And I did the documentary part of it, like the DVD part that's being packaged along with the book, like filming all the interview and editing together the documentary part.
Okay. Now, how did you get involved in filmmaking and such?
Well, I actually went to school for it. I was a film studies major in school, and then I was also a musician, also a punk rock musician, and I had a little career doing that for a while, went out and went out on the road, did that whole for a while. And after that kind of dried up, I came back home and decided maybe it was time to start getting back into my filmmaking stuff. So I was just kind of working on some video stuff, and through my friend Matt, just got in contact with Stan. And, you know, we just kind of started talking about this idea of just paying tribute to, like, all these, like, awesome punk rock bands that we kind of grew up listening to. And I thought it was an awesome idea of just putting together a book and a documentary. And I thought it would be a cool challenge, and originally we were kind of talking about putting together something that would be about a half hour long, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, okay, I could do that. It's no problem. And as I started editing this footage together, I realized, like, oh, my God, how am I going to tell, like, the entire story of Ill Repute in a half hour? So one thing led to another, and next thing you know, we have, like, full-length documentary feature. And, yeah, that's just the way it turned out. But, I mean, it's been a really awesome process, man. I've been stoked to be part of it. It's been great.
Now, Stan and Jeff both, what people don't realize is, sure, it's an hour documentary or an hour and a half documentary, but how much film is actually shot during that time?
I mean, like, I'd say the ratio of, like, what's shot between what's actually used is probably between 10 to 20 to 1. So for every, like, 20 minutes of a video that was shot, we probably would use about 1 minute of it. So, editing on something like this is, that's, like, where all the time-consuming, well, that's the time-consuming part of it. It's just sitting down and listening to all the sound bites and then just kind of crafting together a coherent story out of listening to these guys tell their tale. But the cool thing about Ill Repute is, God, these guys were so easy to work with, and they're so in tune with each other that when you start listening to them telling all these stories, reliving their days, I mean, they have such vivid memories of it for the most part that they're, like, sitting there, like, practically finishing each other's sentences. So that did make the editing part a lot easier, is because they were all talking about the same stories and just enlightening perspectives on it. So it was pretty cool.
Now, this is for both of you guys. This question is for both of you guys. A band that was very formative to a lot of people, Ill Repute, being that band, did you expect those guys? I mean, it seems like they're all great guys. They have great jobs. You know, they're not out, you know, doing drugs and all that stuff. You know, when you see, you know, absolute train wrecks like Dwayne Peters, who's a nice guy, but, you know, he's gone down that path. And
right.
Casey Royer had a lot of problems. Were you guys kind of shocked when, you know, you just had these, you know, cool guys that were just willing to talk?
Yeah.
You want to talk about
that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I think that's what really made this project, you know, fun, because, you know, Jeff and I and our entire team, you know, and you got everybody involved in this, you know, all the people on the back end, I mean, we're putting a lot of time into this, and it's like, and it's hard to do something like this if there's people just that aren't into it, or they're not available, and you need to call them for an interview, and you can't get an interview out of them, and they're non-responsive, it really stops the project, you know, dead. And these guys, you're right, they were so available. They're just like us, you know, they're the working class dudes that you know, that still play music, that still do things that, you know, they play the music that they love. And it really made it, you know, that the process easier for us, because we were able to, you know, work with them, and they were available to us. You know, and you know, like you said, there's people, other bands that, you know, I love and grew up with their music, but yeah, they're not available, you know, and you can't get an interview out of them, and something like that with another band, this project wouldn't have happened. I think for us, just where we're located in Southern California, and this being our first one of the series, I don't think we could have asked for a better project or a better band to work with. I know Jeff and I have had this conversation before, you know, so that's my opinion on it.
Yeah, it was funny. I mean, like, even in the documentary, this girl, Becca Porter from BYO Records, when we were interviewing her, she kept saying, like, oh, yeah, Ill Repute, they're just like, whenever I think of them, I just think they're just, like, such nice guys. And she kept emphasizing that. And the more I kind of, like, spent time around these guys, I realized, like, okay, I get it, why she was emphasizing that. These dudes are, like, the most, like, nice guys for an old-school punk rock band. You know, you usually think of, like, you know, the whole, like, hardcore, like, punk mentality. And, you know, they definitely do have the hardcore punk sound, but, like, their vibe and stuff, they're just, like, such rad dudes to hang out with. And that kind of caught me by surprise in a positive way.
So, what was it, so you guys didn't know what to expect.
Yeah, I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I love the music, but, you know, I had never really met the guys up until this project, so I had no idea what we were going into. And just, you know, as soon as I met Carl right off the bat, I'm all, oh, dude, this guy's awesome. Like, these guys are like, and then met the rest of the guys, and I was like, you know, I couldn't believe that they were such down-to-earth dudes, you know. Really easy to work with, you know, really just super helpful, like, John helped me out with some video stuff. I mean, it was pretty awesome. It was a pretty cool experience.
Now, when you guys first started out with the whole documentary and everything, did you have a script, or did you kind of fly by the seat of your pants?
Well, I think that Stan knew the story of the band a little bit better than I did. He knew the guys a little bit more, and he led all the interviews, you know, asked all the questions to him and everything. So, he kind of knew where to steer the conversations. And I didn't really know, you know, I knew the basics, but I didn't know, like, a lot of the details of, like, you know, what happened on certain tours and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, we had them basically sit down and start to tell the story, and then, you know, it all comes together in the editing room. You know, you piece it together, and, you know, you just kind of, like, pick the parts that do the best job in telling their story and just hope that it does the band justice the way that, you know, it can. And I think it turned out pretty good. I think it did definitely tell the story in a good way. You mean so, Stan?
Yeah, you know, I think also we're book writers, you know, so I didn't understand what a script was, and so yeah, and I was happy that these guys, you know, trusted me to bring this story to them and have them document it, because, you know, I didn't have that experience, and this was a huge learning curve for me. And I know on the next one, we're really talking about how we're going to approach it differently to maximize our time. Because I approached it more like I interview people for books, you know, and maybe that's not the best way to do it, but the story is the story. And
right.
Trying to pull that information out was the key. So, you know, I was stoked that these guys trusted me enough to go up there with me. And, you know, we sleep like 3 hours a night, sleeping on the floor. I mean, I felt like I was a teenager. It was pretty rad. I never experienced that stuff, you know, touring band, you know, you hear about them sleeping on floors or wherever, and you hear the ill repeat stories of them touring, and you're like, oh, that's crazy, but actually that sounds kind of fun, and I never had that, but I kind of got a little bit of that with this experience, you know, and you know, just living on the floor and digging it and didn't care and trying to keep the cost down because it's all coming out of our own pocket, and it worked out, man. I was stoked.
Now, what's next for Stan, but what's next, Jeff? What's next for Firehook Entertainment? Anything planned?
I've got a couple things, like, in the pipeline right now. I've just been doing just some content. I'll go out and film live shows. My buddy Garen and I from Gut Wrenching Productions, we work together, and we'll go out and film, like, some live shows and put together, edit little videos for content for our Punk Rock Chronicle site. But I've also been working with Bill from Dr. Strange Records, and we're going to be putting out a small series of webisodes that we're going to start shooting early next month. So that's kind of like the next thing in the pipeline. And I mean, dude, I'm always working. Like, I'm writing scripts right now. I'm developing a web series. I have a couple of music videos I have coming up. I try and keep myself pretty busy working on other stuff. But, I mean, I'm always going to be working on Rock Chronicle stuff too.
Okay. Well, Jeff, it's been – I want to get you back on at some point, you know, and so you can tell us about more of your the movies coming up, but we need to move along.
Thanks
so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me on, man. Awesome.
Really appreciate it.
Right on.
All right. Thanks.
Cool. All right. Take care.
Okay, Stan, we are now joined by Jeff Hershey. Jeff, welcome to the show. How are you tonight?
Doing good. How's it going?
Good, good. Jeff, explain to us how you got involved in the whole movie with Stan.
Oh man, I don't even remember. Am I involved?
No. You got credit, man. You got credit in there.
Yeah, I did. I guess. No, I don't know. Somebody said, hey, some guy's making a movie on ill repute, and I'm like, who's making a movie on ill repute? And they're like, it's this guy. I said, okay, we need to talk then. Ill repute's just like, you know, I'm from Oxnard. I've been in the music scene since, I don't know, I grew up in it, you know. I'm a big part of it, and there's a lot of people that are a big part of it. Ill repute is the biggest part of it. Stuff like this, you know, like, needs to get handled with care, you know. And Stan was, like, a really cool dude about it from the beginning and understood what was happening. And we just kind of got together and I just wanted to help the film. I wanted to see it win, you know. Because everything that comes from Oxnard, like, doesn't, you know, a lot of it doesn't have a lot of quality, unfortunately. So, you know, if somebody's going to tell the story about this great band, you know, I mean, it's history around here. I was at Goldmine Studio this morning where, you know, Positive Charge was done and the records on the wall and stuff, you know. So I see this stuff every day. So I kind of know from an outsider's point of view, like what it should look like, you know, if that makes any sense at all.
Now, you're also involved, how did you become involved in the whole Nardcore Fest?
I don't know, I guess just being in bands and going to shows. You know, I mean, you're talking about the fest?
Yeah.
Are you talking about Nardfest? Oh, well,
Nardfest.
I mean, I guess I just, you know, had a vision. Actually, as a young kid, I remember I used to live across the street from this field. And I was always like, you know, like my parents were talking about Woodstock and stuff. And I'm like, man, it would be awesome if there was like a Nardcore Woodstock, you know. And I used to look at the field across the street from my house and daydream all the time. Oh, these guys are going to play and these guys are going to play right in that field over there. It's going to be like a whole weekend thing. Obviously, that never happened. But, Nardfest was originally called Nardstock. And I actually got a cease and desist letter from the people who own the Woodstock trademark because of the similarities with it. And so, you know, they wanted to sue me and stuff, so we changed it to Nardfest. But it was cool, you know. It's like we ruffled the feathers of the big bird, if you will, you know. It's good to get on people's radars like that, you know. So, I mean, just a vision it's a legacy show. There's not a lot of, like, current new bands on Nardstock or Nardfest, whatever you want to call it, every year. It's a way to kind of pay tribute to the old school bands and, you know, reunite them, if you will, a lot of them, just for the event, and put them on the big stage and you know, really have, like, an appreciation for what the legacy of the band has been. Instead of just getting together at the Skate Palace, you know, like, hey, we played here 35 years ago, you know, and then a fight breaks out and the show is over, you know.
Right, right. Now, where were you guys going to shows at out there when you first started going to shows and seeing Ill Repute and Solid 13 and Dr. No and Aggression?
I mean, just basically any place that would do the show, you know. I wasn't around in the early 80s. I wasn't around in the early parts of it, but, I mean, I know places are still here. I mean, the buildings at least, you know. I mean, just anywhere somebody would rent a hall. I mean, we used to do shows at the National Guard, like at the Armory, you know. They would just have a gymnasium, and somebody's dad would rent it or something, you know, and just there you go, you have a show. Or a lot of backyard parties, too, back in the day. There's a laser tag place we were doing shows at for a couple of years that were going really strong. A lot of the bars and a lot of the mid-sized concert venues out here have closed down, which is pretty sad. But, you know, there's always a place to find a show. Knights of Columbus Hall, I mean, you name it, anything we could rent or try and get like that, you know, it would work out pretty well. Or not, you know. But generally there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, just like rock clubs to play, places meant for doing that stuff, you know, which
right.
is, I guess, could
now,
be
Stan,
the, you know, the situation in any small town. Go ahead.
Now, Jeff, you're still involved in music, correct? You're not just putting on the fest.
Yeah.
You're still involved in music. You have your own band, correct?
Yeah. I play in quite a few different things. I play bass in a heavy metal band called Night Demon. But yeah, that band's going pretty well, and I sing in like a soul garage punk kind of band. So yeah, definitely performing is my passion. I mean, that's my first love is the actual music itself. But it's also good to get involved on all ends of it and to promote shows that I know are going to be awesome. I don't necessarily have to be on the show for me to have an interest in it, you know?
Right.
So that's kind of what the Nardfest thing is all about.
Now, Stan, how did you approach, you know, Jeff really to get on board with Nardfest and to coincide the music?
Yeah, you know, well, from what I remember, we were just filming it, and he's all, "Yeah, I'm putting on the show. You guys,
you think you guys can complete it in time? You guys can play it there. And I said, you know, we just said, yeah, we were fired up for the filming of it. And it was that first weekend when I met Jeff. And, yeah, he just hit us up and we said, yeah, we'll do it. And right when we had a deadline, we knew it was on. We had to get this thing done. We're committed.
Yeah.
And Jeff was a media hound. So it's like, you know, our names on all the flyers, you know, the projects on there. We're in newspaper, we're in articles now. We're doing, you know, radio shows, you know, we're helping promote the show. And it's like, you know, we're committed now. So we had to make sure that we were going to get something to play. And that's where, you know, it came in to have the right team, you know, to work with Jeff and Matt to get this stuff done because, you know, I'm not the documentarian. I didn't have those abilities. You know, if those guys happened to leave, I'd be like the one sitting there going, how am I going to do this, you know? And so having the right team was essential. But I knew with the passion that we had that week in filming and we were approached with the, you know, I knew it would get done. I really didn't have a doubt. And it just went
and
well,
this,
man. That
it came
was a
close,
show.
But
yeah,
close. Close.
It always comes close, man. It always comes close.
This year
but.
Is actually like a continuation, like a part two almost, you know, because Ilary Pugh is going to headline the fest this year, playing their album What Happens Next from front to back. It's the 30th anniversary of that record, so that'll be really special. There's some songs on there that the band hasn't played in, God, probably since the thing came out. Just a couple, but they play most of them. But, yeah, so they're going to play that in its entirety. And we're going to be doing the release of the book and the DVD, the actual physical copies at the show. So
yeah,
last year
our first,
we had the movie party. And now they were reviewed, so yeah.
Yeah, full circle. That's what's special to us, too, is how, you know, we were given this opportunity with Jeff, and then we've done a full circle. It's been 1 year since we showed it to people. Now it's for sale, and it's a special occasion for us. We're stoked to even have this opportunity, you know, to put something out like this and to have this kind of back and to have this kind of support from the community. I mean, the community has really come out for this, you know, and it's just we couldn't ask for, like I said, I mean, I've said it a million times, for a better band to work with and better group of people than the Nardcore scene.
Now, Jeff, with the Nardcore Fest or Nardfest, have you announced the full lineup yet?
No, not yet. We're about there. There's probably going to be another two like headliner caliber bands announced. The show goes on sale April 4th. We did just confirm a reunion of In Control for this show, and that's a big deal out here.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really big deal. That
wow.
band out here was the band that really carried the torch, like, from the late 90s on. And they put out a few records on Indecision. They toured. I mean, they did really well. But as far as, I mean, people out here, I mean, that they are really, like, an Oxnard band, you know? I mean, lyrically, I mean, there's a lot of songs about Oxnard. It's definitely within control, you know? I mean, they took, the logo is the In Control logo from the Solid 13 record. So, but definitely, they're definitely local favorites coming into this. I mean, there's been a lot of people talking about them getting back together for a long time, and they're just, you know, they're not going to go for it, but they're doing it for this show, and I think it's really cool.
All right, cool. All right. Well, I want to play another song, and Jeff, I want to get you back on when you're ready to after you've made the announcement, and talk to you about an art fest if you'd be interested. So,
absolutely, man.
That'd be great. All right. Well, hey, thanks for coming on tonight, and I will
Thank
be
you
in
guys.
Touch.
All right, we'll see you.
All right, thanks. Okay, Stan, I'm gonna play my favorite song by Ill Repute, which it's commonly called Cherokee Nation.
Nice.
And then when we come back, we will have Carl joining us on the other line.
Oh, all right.
All right, this is Ill Repute with Cherokee Nation.
Yeah.
Tonight. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you.
Now, Carl, I'm really excited to have you on here because Ill Repute has been a favorite of mine for a very long time. First, how did the band form?
Well, it all started while we were in high school, I guess, is how it all formed. The four of us went to high school together. Tony and I had a little garage band while we were in high school. And so we had been playing music together since we were 14. Then when the punk rock movement took off in the late 70s, early 80s, Tony, Jim, and John, they just gravitated right to it. And I was still a hard rocker at that time, and I really didn't want anything to do with it. They had asked me to play with them. Drummers were pretty scarce in that during that time, and they wanted to start a band, and they thought about a couple other guys. They may have had a practice or two with some other guys, and finally I went to a party. I saw how popular punk rock was really in Oxnard, just all the different people, especially the girls, and I went up to Tony and Jim that night. I went up to Tony and Jim that night and said, let's start practicing.
I like that story. That's a good story. So
it's funny. That's the truth, and I've never varied from that story. That is the honest truth in my heart. That's what got me into this band.
Well, hey, you know what? You were a kid. That's what drove us all back then.
That's true.
Now, Carl, did you ever play anything other than drums?
Yeah, I grew up playing clarinet. Ever since I was in fourth grade, I played clarinet until junior high, and my junior high instructor mistook me for another student who wanted to learn how to play the drums. That's how I kind of broke into the drumming, and she came up to me and said, I heard you wanted to learn how to play the drums, and I always wanted to, but I never mentioned it to her. And she said, okay, why don't you come after school and I'll give you some lessons. So she was showing me how to play the drums. And it's funny is because the other guy never ended up playing the drums at all. I became a drummer from that point on. I was doing both clarinet and drums pretty much through high school. And then when Tony and I started our band, the first band, all I wanted to be was a rock drummer for the rest of my life. I play other instruments. I play guitar a little bit, play a little piano, French horn, saxophone. I have a little music studio at my home here. So.
All right. Now, where did you get your talent from? Is there anybody in your family you can point to as kind of the source of that?
Definitely my dad. My dad was the kind of guy who had been, you know, he was in the military, been around the world a number of times, and he could pick up any instrument on the fly. Rumor was, well, my mom told me later on after my dad passed away that my parents used to live with me in one of the peaks of ill repute. When we did the Big Rusty Balls album, my parents lived with me, and they lived in our and we practiced in the living room. And my mom told me that when I would go off to work, my dad would just be jamming on all the instruments all day long. So he was a natural musician. And so me and my brother, is a professional bass player out in Indiana, a professional blues bass player in Indiana.
Wow.
We pretty much got the talent from my dad, for sure.
Okay. Now, when Ill Repute first got together, Oxnard was really just a simmering, fire before you guys and your Nardcore contemporaries arrived on the scene. How did that, how was that spark? And it just literally blew up. Because I remember, I grew up in Philadelphia, and I remember a lot of the East Coast bands, the Orange County bands, boom, you had Dr. No, you had Stalag 13, you had Aggression, you had you guys. And it was like overnight, everybody finally noticed that Oxnard had this just astronomically good scene. How do you feel that, why did that happen so quickly and, almost overnight?
Well, I think there was always good talent here. And, I'm not any great punk rock historian by any means, because it was going on for about a year or so by the time I got really involved with it. But I think because we were an hour and a half outside of L.A. and everybody came back to suburban Oxnard, I think all the punks started – I think, the story I hear is they were going to L.A. and not even knew each other in Oxnard. And people like Ismael from Dr. No and Tony and John and then the guys in Aggression, they were going to L.A. separately, and then they'd come home and they'd see each other at a party and say, hey, I saw you at Godzilla's last week. So what happened was the Nardcore group just kind of all gravitated toward each other. We all had parties. We used to play so many parties where the parties would be Aggression, Dr. No, and Ill Repute, and then later on Stalag 13. That would be a regular house party that went on for about a year, and it blew. Aggression got on BYO Records. They did somebody got their head kicked in, and they told us, hey, you guys could do a demo tape. There's a studio that's doing $120, and you could record all night. So we did a demo tape, and the next thing, Dr. No does one, and then it's just all these bands that started formulating, because I think it was from the environment of growing up in Oxnard, which is basically a farm town, and right next to it is a military base. So
right.
I guess farming and military bases produces angry teen angst.
I can see that. Now, Stan, what's your take on it? I mean, why do you think Oxnard and the Nardcore scene just seemed to blow up?
Yeah, it was Aggression really started it. They were the first band to really get noticed. And then, then Ill Repute came on, and Dr. No, Stalag 13, False Confessions, and all those bands. But the music was just radical, man. It was just, I didn't even know anything about Oxnard. I just knew that these bands were ripping, and I'd hear their music, and I was just, gravitated to it. And I was, compared to Black Flag, another amazing hardcore bands,
right.
And a lot of the East Coast bands, they just happened to come from this area, and they were a group of bands that grew up together, and which made it even cooler. Their music was just amazing, and just for me, like I mentioned earlier, just going and when you're a kid and you go buy records, I don't even know who these bands were. I just know that I picked up a Mystic sampler, you know, one time and liked the song. So every time I go to the record shop, I buy Mystic records and buy, you know, an Ill Repute was on every compilation they ever came out with
and
know, put out some cool albums on it. And, you know, that's how I think that helped get them out there too, just the whole Mystic and also that first compilation they were on with Posh Boy Records, you know, with when they played Clean Cut American Kid. I mean, that you know, they got a lot of attention for that too. So, you know, they're just a rad band that, you know, people really wanted to listen to, and I think it just gravitated across the country and even internationally too. You know, they're known all over the world.
Right. Now, Carl,
I think
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that was really unique about all the four bands is that we used to hang out with each other all the time, but I always thought that the music of each four original bands was all very different. Aggression was very much surf and skate influenced. Dr. No was very, you know, Kyle was just very into Black Sabbath and just turned it into a punk band. We were just more of a raw band of just four guys who were friends who learned how to play instruments together, wanted to have a pretty decent positive image while we were up there. Same with Star Wars 13. Ronnie was very influenced by Minor Threat, and that kind of carries out into their style. So I think kind of what boosted the whole Narco scene is that you had four bands that were good bands, but they all had different styles too. So it wasn't like just this one sound that came out of Oxnard.
No, yeah, I got to agree with you there. It is a very diverse sound that formed Nardcore, and it was a very good sound.
Yeah,
now,
definitely.
Carl, how did you guys get signed to Mystic Records? I mean, that's a legendary label, and you guys were on a lot of Mystic Record albums.
Yeah, I'm thinking the story came out was we got on the We Got Power compilation. You know, we were hanging out down in LA a lot. I think we somehow made the connection with the guys who were doing the We Got Power compilation. And I think that first We Got Power compilation had like 40 bands on it. And so we said, hey, we've got a demo tape. We gave them a song. We gave them a version of one song called Count the Odds. And that got on the compilation. The compilation went really big. Rumor has it one of the bands on there is the bass player of Pearl Jam's old punk band. I can't remember which band it was, but he was on that compilation album as well. And when they were compiling together, I think Mystic offered, you know, liked the song and said, hey, do you guys want to do a record here? Clean Cut American Kid was already done as well. And he offered us and he said, hey, do you guys want to do a record here? And he said, I'll pay for half if you guys pay for half. And that was going to come out to about $1,500. You know, back then, I mean, $1,500 today is a lot of money. So
right.
We're talking 30-plus years ago, someone was asking us for $1,500. He may as well have asked us for $15 million because we thought we're not going to have anybody. You know, where are we going to come up with $1,500? Well, it just so happens one of my best friends at the time, this guy that we all went to high school, we grew up with, his name was Mike Terry. And Mike was one of my best friends when I first started playing the drums. And I got to tell you the story. I used to practice my drums every day after school. And Mike would just come over to my house and watch me play my drums because he just thought I was this great drummer. I was 15 years old, and he just thought I was like the greatest drummer ever. And I'm playing Boston and Kiss and Bad Company and Cheap Trick, and he just wanted to watch me play. Well, as Mike and I became really close, he always told me, Carl, if you ever need help with anything in boosting your music career, you let me know. So fast forward a few more years, and Ill Repute sitting around, wow, where are we going to get $1,500 from? Well, I knew that Mike's father had just passed away and left him a ton of cash. And I said, I'm going to ask Mike Terry. And the guys looked at me like, why the hell would you ask Mike Terry for $1,500? So I told the story, and they're like, well, let's give it a shot. I mean, asking Mike Terry would have been just like asking, you know, any school teacher. I was just like a random person. Mike was not into the punk scene at all. He just was like, he was just a good friend of all of ours. We hung out with him. So I called Mike up and I said, hey, we got this opportunity to come out with a record, but they want someone to pay for half. You think you'll do it? He goes, oh, let me meet with the guy. So Mike went, met with Doug Moody, signed a contract, wrote him a check for $1,500, and next thing you know, we're on Mystic Records. And from that point forward, we never put another dime into any of our music once again after that. I mean, obviously the success of the records paid for itself down the road, but it was all because of Mike. Mike was the one who originally invested in the band, and I guess we could always say that we owe each other, we owe everything to Mike. And, you know, Mike went off to do his own life, and he's a manager for Boeing, and, you know, and he just has his regular family life in Texas. And he and I reconnected a couple of years ago, and Mike has a box full of the original Land of No Toilets, original pressing, all clear vinyl. He's got about 16 of them still that Mystic had given him. And I told Mike that they're worth a lot of money now, so I guess that's your payment.
I bet they would be.
Yeah.
Oh, man. He is sitting on a gold mine there. Well, small gold mine, but definitely sitting on one. Now, you guys wrote, a lot of your music was about what you saw every day. Was Oxnard just a really rich place to be able to write punk music?
I would say yes, it's definitely a rich place to write punk music. It's, you know, like I said, it's a farming industry here, and it borders another city that is military. So you have a lot of kids, like John and Jimmy, well, all four of us, but John and Jimmy especially, their fathers retired at the base that was right next to us. So, you know, it's a lot of military structure that kids were growing up with. I was the youngest, and my father is already retired, so I never grew up around that. But, you know, Tony's father just passed away a few weeks ago, and at his father's funeral, the sisters were up at the eulogy talking about how his father was giving military inspections for their bedrooms and stuff like that. And I know that Jimmy and John had also grown up that way, had to have short hair, you know, coat and tie whenever they went out, you know, and I think because of that, you know, led to a lot of rebellion during the punk rock scene, because you grown up around this military environment, and we're talking about, you know, Vietnam era or post-Vietnam era, so there's just a lot of rebellion going on there. Now, the other side of the tracks is the Oxnard scene, where it's lower middle class, a lot of farming, you know, a lot of people, a lot of the punks that we knew, you know, both parents worked, if they even had both parents in the household. A lot of Hispanics had parents that were literally working in the farm, in the field. So you had a lot of lower middle class culture that I think lent to being something that you would write punk rock songs about.
Now, did you ever consider, I mean, I know you said you got in it for the girls, but did you ever consider anything else other than the music? I mean, early on, were you just like, we're not really going to go anywhere. This is, you know, it's a waste of my time. Did you ever feel that was the case?
Well, we all had day jobs, so to speak. I mean, I think to this day, I work for the city of Ventura. I've been working for the city of Ventura since 1984. So while I was having a decent day job, I remember when I first got my first day job, the guys in the band were pissed because, like, hey, what are you getting a day job for? You know, those three guys had odd jobs and stuff, but, you know, we never really knew what was going to become of this. We never did it for the money, obviously. We just wanted to be four guys that just wanted to be in a band and play. That was my whole thing. I just want to play. I didn't like the business part of things. We just wanted to play, and if someone says, hey, you know, you guys want to play a party in L.A.? like, okay, next thing you know, we're playing this party. Our very first party in L.A., I mean, I shit you not, Black Flag, Sin 34, a couple other bands, and this other brand-new band called Suicidal Tendencies. And
oh,
they were
wow.
going to open, and they were going to open for us. And I remember Mike Muir getting mad at the guys throwing the party. I was like, why is this band from Oxnard headlining over us, and they're not even from L.A.? You know, and you know, Clean Cut American Kid was already out at this time, but, you know, they felt like since they're from L.A. that they should have played after us, and it was a big deal. We don't care. But yeah, Black Flag and Sin 34 were playing the same party that we were playing. So there's some people that say, hey, and then it was like, oh, do you guys want to play here? The gig was Circle One. Oh, that'd be cool. And there's, you know, people, hey, do you want to play here? Do you want to play there? And we just kept doing it. And, you know, record company says, hey, do you guys want to do a record? Do you want to do another record? Oh, you guys should go on tour. We didn't know what was happening at the moment. We just kind of just, we're just doing whatever was, felt natural. And we never sat down and thought, let's be musicians. I mean, there were opportunities where Circle One, for example, they always wanted me to be their drummer. But I was so, I guess, committed and dedicated and loyal to my friends. They were friends first. I was like, oh, I'm not going to join some band in L.A. That's ridiculous. That, to me, it was really, it was a thought like I never even thought of that. Even though I was a lifelong musician, I never thought that's what you needed to do.
Right.
Keith Morris thought I was the best drummer he'd ever seen at that time. And maybe if there was an opportunity after Lucky had left, maybe I could have played with Circle Jerks. I don't know. There was a time when Bobby Scheer, who was the drummer for Bad Religion in the early
right.
90s, he wanted me to be his drum tech. And I
oh,
was
wow.
so full of myself, and I thought, why would I want to be somebody else's drum tech? Even though it was Bad Religion, and they were huge at the time still, you know, not, I, and that's one of my, I wouldn't say biggest regrets, but it was one of my problems, was not having the forethought to think, oh, if I was their drum tech, if he had left the band, maybe I would have been their drummer. You know, I never thought of those kind of things. We just
right.
did what we did, and we just had fun with it. And whenever we took a little break, we would have Tony and John. Tony was just a songwriting machine. Tony's one of my best friends, and to this day, I think Tony's one of the best songwriters that I know personally. He and I have this new band called Mother of Dissension, and we just finished recording a new album with that, and the songs that Tony wrote on that are just excellent. Yeah. I mean, think about Clean Cut American Kid has two
right.
chords in it. I mean, and it's an
right.
epic punk song with two chords. Even the Ramones songs had three chords.
Right.
So, well, yeah, so it was nothing I never even thought of, yeah.
Well, guys, we are at the end of the show right now. I do want to, once the movie comes out, Stan, Carl, I'd love to get you guys.
Oh, definitely, anytime.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thanks for having us.
Okay, yeah, thanks for coming on, guys, and I will be in touch.
Thank you. Okay.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Good night.
Okay.
Okay, guys, we're going to finish off tonight with a quick song by Ill Repute. It's Bad Reputation. Thanks for joining us tonight. Next week, I'm working on a guest. Don't have them worked out just yet. But this is Bad Reputation by Ill Repute. Thanks for listening.